This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
It was a conscious decision that he made to do what he did. And of course, the government's going to try to get him, and he knew that. So he is.
I want to thank you both for being with us, yep. Bill Binney and Glenn Greenwald. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
The time is 5 p.m., and you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. And coming up next is the evening news.
Native Americans account for less than 2% of Oregon's population, yet we make up greater than 4% of its prison population. I'm Trish Jordan of Red Lodge Transition Services. We began our work in Oregon prisons advocating for religious freedom and human rights. Join me on Prison Pipeline June 10th to hear how Red Lodge helps Native American women rebuild their lives after incarceration, often helping them reconnect to Native spirituality and culture. That's Prison Pipeline June 10th at 6:30 p.m.
Hi, this is Judy Collins, and wishing KBOO Radio a happy 45th anniversary.
Our listeners in Corvallis and Albany will be happy to hear that we have replaced the failed translator and installed a brand new translator. It is also in a new location in Philomath and on a new frequency. KBOO's new frequency for Corvallis, Albany, and Philomath is 104.3.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon Senate passes a bill that would allow private contractors to sue environmental activists who protest logging by using tactics like tree sit-ins and road blockades.
We talk with the political science professor at PSU about Edward Snowden, the NSA whistleblower.
And a wave of bombings in Iraq kills at least 70 people in one day. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 10th, 2013. I'm John Rasmussen.
And I'm Serena Fong. A female student was assaulted on the campus of Portland State University this past Saturday. According to campus officials who posted a safety bulletin regarding the incident, the student was assaulted in an elevator at Neuberger Hall at approximately 3:40 in the afternoon by a man who had followed her from the Max. The man is described as being white, 6 feet tall, with green eyes and a shaved bald head. He was wearing a wide-brimmed straw safari hat and green cargo shorts at the time of the incident. The student who was attacked was not reportedly physically injured. A similar incident happened on April 28th at Neuberger Hall, and campus public safety and Portland police are seeking more information about the attacker.
The state Senate passed a bill today that would make protesters on state forest land financially liable to contractors who do business with the State Department of Forestry. The bill would allow contractors to sue protesters for financial damages relating to loss of employee wages, damages to equipment, and legal costs. A previous version of the bill passed the House in April. The new Senate version caps the statute of limitations to sue for damages at 2 years instead of six, as mandated by the House bill. The House must approve the changes to the bill before it is sent to the desk of Governor John Kitzhaber. A companion law, which would have created the crime of interference with state forests and management, which passed in the House, did not survive the Senate. KBOO's Mike Clefford spoke to Mount Hood Preservation Group Bark staff attorney Brenda Bell about this bill.
Do you feel it's legitimate to ask protesters to pay damages to contractors?
Well, I think what this does is set a very dangerous precedent that the state can legislate private industries going after activists who are just really, you know, working to protect the public environment. And, you know, who knows? It's a completely slippery slope. What's the next business that wants its assets to be protected and will ask the legislature to act? You know, it also shows how the timber industry totally has a hold on Salem politics. Even though timber is kind of a bygone economic era already in Oregon.
Under the law, as it's being drafted right now, would these protesters be liable to pay damages?
First, I'd say the law that just passed. So we're working with something that looks like it will be actual the law of the land.
Mm-hmm.
And the type of protest that it's targeting is nonviolent civil disobedience protest. This often shows up in forest protests in the form of tree sits and road blockades and people actively putting their bodies between the machinery and the forests. What we've been seeing the last couple of years is the state of Oregon has been increasing clear-cutting old growth on state lands, especially the Elliott State Forest, and people have been reacting to that by doing civil disobedience and protests. Currently, a lot of those timber sales are stopped by lawsuit, but it was some of the time that was bought by the protests that kept the forest standing for the lawsuit to take place. So these are the exact type of activities that will be targeted by this bill.
Can you talk about the land use changes that happened in the Elliott State Forest in 2011 and how they have sort of ratcheted up the pressure to log there?
Are you talking about the State Land Use Board's vote?
Yes.
On that? Okay. So in 2011, the State Land Board did vote to increase clear-cutting of old growth on state lands under the rhetoric that it needed to do it to pay for schools. And, you know, as a parent with a child in Portland Public Schools, I think it's absolutely ludicrous to be liquidating our children's future to pay for the schools. And there was a large protest of that meeting, and we told them as much, that obviously we should be looking for a more sustainable source of funding for our schools than clear-cutting old growth on public lands.
What would you say to a politician like Governor Kitzhaber that looks to logging to fill budgetary gaps?
I think I would say, please start looking forward and not backward. You know, assuming that we can continue to rely on Oregon's natural resources as our economic breadbasket is a fallacy. You know, we've eaten that bread. The environment has been irreparably damaged by people looting it for private profit. And it is incumbent upon the leaders to think of something new, to really look at how we can base an economy on things that are truly sustainable and do not, you know, kind of rob the riches of the last hundreds of years of growth in the forests. So it's time to get over the myth that Oregon is a timber state, and not create laws specifically to pad the timber industry's pockets at the expense of all of the rest of us.
So is BARC working on this issue?
BARC actively worked to stop both this bill and its companion bill, which would have increased criminal penalties on forest activists. So even though we typically don't work on state issues, we feel that this has a chilling effect on all environmental activism and activism in general, and don't want to see it, you know, increase into federal forests as well. So we lobbied and went to Salem and talked to our legislatures and encouraged our members to do likewise. And we were very gratified to see that that one of the bills did not pass, but are sad that, you know, in what looks like a massive political compromise, they're allowing private timber companies to sue environmental activists for damages for blocking forests.
That was KBOO's Mike Lepfer.
This week, high schools across Oregon are celebrating graduation ceremonies. But a report by the federal government on high school graduation rates shows that Oregon has a lot to work on. It currently has the fourth worst graduation rate in the nation. Only 68% of students in the state are graduating on time, compared to a national average of nearly 80%. Portland School District ranks as the fifth worst in the state. Lincoln, Wilson, Grant, and Benson High Schools have the highest graduation rates out of the Portland Public Schools, with over 80% of their students graduating on time. Among these better performing schools, Benson Polytechnic High School, which is celebrating its graduation today, has the highest ethnic diversity of students. Amy Henry, the counselor at Benson, says there is a reason why Benson's graduation rates are so high.
Well, I think that students at Benson see the relevancy of school, and they, because of our connection to the world of work. And so because all of our students here take career technical education classes, they see the connection between school and what the skills they're going to need after they graduate from high school. So that relevancy is just such a key ingredient for students to stay in school.
Franklin, Cleveland, and Madison high schools have around 70% of their students graduating on time, and Roosevelt and Jefferson's graduation rates are around 50%. Small alternative charter schools in Oregon have among the lowest graduation rates at around 20%.
Fewer Oregon children are showing up for free summer meals for low-income families, despite a significant increase in sites and sponsors. A new national report on summer meal trends says the decrease is because there were fewer summer school and activity programs to attract kids. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service, Serena Fong has more.
Many lower-income children in Oregon are not getting the free summer meals available to them. A new report from the Food Research and Action Center, or FRAC, says more than 207,000 Oregon children get free or reduced-price lunches at school, but only 36,000 receive the free summer meals. One dilemma is that summer food is often tied to summer school or enrichment programs. And Crystal Fitzsimmons with the FRAC says budget cuts have shortened or ended many of those activities.
The programs are not serving all the kids that they should, and part of the big problem, and this is true in urban, suburban, and rural areas, is that there are not enough summer programs for low-income children to keep them safe, engaged, and active during the summer months.
Oregon's drop in participation was only 1%, although statewide it means for every 100 children who receive free or reduced-price meals during the school year, only about 18 get the same benefit in the summer. The USDA has made it a goal this summer to increase the meals served by 5 million nationwide. The report says the USDA has made an effort to minimize the paperwork requirements for meal program sponsors. Fitzsimmons says another challenge is making the more than 700 meal sites around the state convenient for kids and families.
Transportation is one of the big barriers to the summer nutrition programs, and it is harder in communities that are rural to get kids to and from summer sites. And it can be hard even in some urban areas where, you know, transportation might be limited.
The report says about half the states saw fewer children receiving summer meals in 2012 compared with 2011, which runs counter to the increased need that's been seen during the school years since the recession. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service, this is Serena Fong with KBOO News. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for free speech radio news after this newscast, followed by Labor Radio, discussions on working class issues at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline, connecting with the community inside. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be partly sunny and partly cloudy, with highs near 65. Clouds should continue into the evening, lows around 50 degrees.
It's 5:13, time for Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
I'll bet that Mark Twain, who wrote the celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, would have loved a current saga that I call The Jumping Congress Critter of Frog Jump, Tennessee. The critter's name is Stephen Fincher, a millionaire agribusiness operator, gospel singer, and Tea Party Republican who was elected to Congress in 2010 from the greater metropolitan area of Frog Jump. Declaring limited government to be his priority, the 40-year-old right-winger recently jumped all over the food stamp budget, demanding that $20 billion and 2 million poverty-stricken families be chopped out of the program. In his attack, Fincher cited an odd moral source to rationalize his minginess toward America's poor families, the Bible. "The one who is unwilling to work shall not eat," declared the Bible-thumping budget whacker, quoting the Book of Thessalonians. Of course, several passages in the Bible depict Jesus teaching an exact opposite moral code, indeed, a heavenly duty of generosity toward the poor. But Fincher the Austerian was not about to let Jesus trump the Tea Party's small government dogma. "We have to remember," he lectured, "that this is other people's money that Washington is appropriating and spending." "Piously put, sir." But then, the critter from Frog Jump suddenly leapt to another budgetary lily pad. Now, the limited government ideologue became a croaking free spender, demanding a $9 billion increase in a taxpayer subsidy program that protects, guess who, the income of a few agribusiness outfits like his. This is Jim Hightower saying, in fact, Fincher is the second largest recipient of farm subsidies in Congress, having taken at least $3.5 million in, quote, other people's money in the past dozen years. For more information on this hopping hypocrite, go to Environmental Working Group at EWG.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at LaborRadio.org.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Independent truck drivers operating out of the Port of Savannah are seeking representation with the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. The drivers, who move more than 80% of the freight, say they're being misclassified as independent contractors by companies at the port. Jim Cosmo Myrick is one of those drivers, and he explained why the misclassification hurts drivers.
Due to the misclassification, it allows the companies that we actually work for to call us independent contractors, therefore releasing them from having to pay any employee benefits such as health insurance, unemployment, or retirement. And that's not to mention the taxes that they probably avoid by labeling us as independent.
Myrick said it was deregulation of the trucking industry that led to companies abusing the system. He said being an independent trucker isn't the same as being an independent plumber or carpenter.
We're not independent, though, such as, say, a plumber or a framer or a carpenter. We don't have the independency of moving freight for another company. We are contracted to these people.
A bill that passed unanimously in Connecticut at the end of May will limit the state's participation in a controversial federal program called Secure Communities. Melinda Tuhus reports.
The new law, called the Trust Act, will restrict the use of immigration detainers, which are requests from the Federal Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to local and state law enforcement to hold an undocumented immigrant until immigration officials can take custody of him or her. Ana Maria Rivera, a legal and policy analyst with Junta for Progressive Action in New Haven, says that since Secure Communities went into effect in Connecticut last year, many undocumented immigrants went back into the shadows and avoided contact with police.
We also had stories that were really compelling, stories of people, even citizens, that had been turned over to ICE because there was a mistake, people that had no criminal conviction. And we also had the support of law enforcement. Law enforcement went to testify at the public hearing and said, we have been working so hard for the last couple of years to build the bridge between law enforcement and the immigrant community. And so we want to have that trust back.
Connecticut's law is the first state law in the country to limit the reach of ICE and the Secure Communities program. Melinda Tuhus, Workers Independent News, New Haven.
The Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from the Bank of Labor, a division of Brotherhood Bank and Trust, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor is union-owned, union-represented, and the bank of choice for unions and their members. Now you can do business with a bank that shares labor values. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
KBOO's Jimmy Tardy spoke with Bruce Gilley, Associate Professor of Political Science at Portland State University, about the revelations of Edward Snowden, a former contractor for NSA secret surveillance programs, and how those revelations affect U.S.-China relations. President Obama hosted Chinese President Xi Jinping over the weekend.
I'm speaking with Associate Professor Bruce Gilley of the Hatfield School of Government, the College of Urban and Public Affairs, at Portland State University. Professor Gilley, we're shocked with the revelations by Mr. Snowden regarding the NSA wiretapping, and understand that prior to these revelations, President Obama was expected to bring up the issue of cyber attacks and surveillance and this type of thing with Mr. Xi of China. And now the thinking is that that will not happen. What do you think the fallout from this will be?
Well, I think both of these news stories are highlighting the growing importance of
network security for both governments and citizens, actually. And the National Security Advisor, Tom DeLonge, said that cybersecurity was now at the center of the U.S.-China relationship. I think the question that arises from both the Snowden revelations and from what has now become defined as the center of the China-U.S. relationship is, you know, how do governments, on the one hand, conduct their government business, on the other hand, protect themselves against other governments, and also limit themselves in how they make use of their cybersecurity and cyber technology. As increasing amounts of social life migrate onto the internet, it's natural that our law enforcement agencies and national security agencies should migrate their surveillance onto the internet as well. As with any form of surveillance, you know, there's a question of how one balances law enforcement against individual freedoms. And, you know, this is something we've been dealing with for more than 50 years here. And, you know, the internet is a kind of a new platform for that. But the link here is, what do you do when the government, perhaps legally and legitimately, is beginning to collect a lot of data, and at the same time, that data is being accessible to people and organizations that might be vulnerable to hacking by foreign governments interested in the same things that your government is. And this is what we've seen with China. So the more data we accumulate, the more vulnerable we are to having that data being compromised by potentially hostile countries. The same thing arises. Snowden is telling us how much surveillance data is being gathered by the government. Whether or not that's legitimate is one question. But the second question is that as China in particular and Russia become increasingly active in acquiring data illegally from the United States, both private sector data and government data, it's a new question to consider in asking ourselves the limit of surveillance by our own government. Don't forget, when you're a government hiring a contractor to acquire information illegally from other countries, there's little or no risk in hiring a contractor. When you hire a contractor to manage your own classified data, the risk is much greater. And in China's case, you can be sure that they do not contract out anything that involves handling of sensitive data.
Handling of their own sensitive data, whereas we
right.
do contract that same thing out.
Yeah, that's our new public model of managing government, is to contract out. And the problem is that sometimes it's just something that's inappropriate.
Do you think that the Obama administration has a leg to stand on in their talks with China regarding the efforts of China to conduct espionage digitally of United States?
Yeah, and I think that the problem for China is that internally they don't have control over a lot of the hacking, or most of the hacking that's going on. Either it's done by the military, and the party leaders in China cannot tell the military what to do and what not to do, or it's done by companies and private sector groups in China, and China has difficulty making sure its companies follow any laws, whether it's product safety or stock market disclosure requirements, and it certainly isn't going to be able to stop them from hacking into American or other foreign data sources. And so China's strategy right now is just straight denial. But you can be sure behind closed doors what they're telling their American counterparts is, we don't have a way to solve this problem very easily.
What you described sounds similar to what's been happening in this country with blanket denials. And if we're contracting this work out, and as Mr. Snowden said, he had potential access to anyone's communication, even the president's, it sounds as if we're ripe for abuse in our own system.
We are. On the other hand, we have a process through which we can discuss these issues with the facts in front of us. I think Senator Feinstein, as well as President Obama, have, you know, welcomed scrutiny and welcomed discussions about the appropriate limits of surveillance. Of course, the way this has to be done is through our democratically elected representatives who sit on committees with access to classified information, and we need to trust their judgment when they come away from those meetings and say that the surveillance is appropriate or it needs to be adjusted. The difference is China doesn't have that kind of process through which it could agree as a society what the appropriate limits of espionage or surveillance are. It's an issue that is going to just get bigger as more and more of our government and our social lives migrate onto the internet, this is really the new social sphere where a lot of new politics and foreign relations is going to take place.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking with Bruce Gilley. He's associate professor at the Hatfield School of Government, College of Urban and Public Affairs. Thanks again.
Thanks.
That was KBOO's Jimmy Tardy speaking with Gil Skilley about NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden.
A wave of bombings across Iraq has killed at least 70 people today, many in the northern city of Mosul. Four bombings occurred in western Mosul, including rocket attacks targeting military installations and police, killing as many as 28 people. Three attackers were among the dead, and an additional 80 people were wounded, according to a police official. Car bombs exploded at multiple open-air markets in northern Iraq earlier in the day, leaving dozens dead and hundreds wounded. So far, no single group has claimed responsibility for the attacks. Iraq's sectarian violence has dramatically worsened as of late, with around 2,000 people being killed since April. The conflict is between Iraq's Sunni majority, which have been politically marginalized since the fall of former dictator Saddam Hussein, and Iraq's Shiites, who became politically dominant after the United States invasion in 2003.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, June 10, 2013. Israeli soldiers injure a farmer in Gaza and kidnap civilians during invasions targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian sources reported on Monday that a farmer was seriously injured after being targeted by Israeli army fire while working in his land in southern Gaza. The sources said that Ammar Abu Hadaida, 22, suffered a serious injury after he was shot by a live round to the chest, exiting from his back as he was working in his land in Khan Yunis. The fire came from soldiers manning one of the military towers across the borders with Gaza. Hadaida was moved to the Gaza European Hospital and was immediately admitted to surgery before being moved to the intensive care unit. The army frequently attacks Palestinian farmers and workers working close to the borders areas in Gaza. Dozens of casualties have been reported. Soldiers also repeatedly invade border areas in the coastal region, uproot farmlands and property. Elsewhere on Monday morning, dozens of Israeli soldiers invaded the southern West Bank district of Hebron, broke into several homes and kidnapped seven Palestinians before taking them to unknown destinations. Local sources in Al Arub refugee camp north of Hebron reported that Israeli soldiers kidnapped two young men from the camp. The sources added that the army also broke into several homes and searched them, and that local youth hurled stones at invading soldiers who fired rubber-coated steel bullets and gas bombs. Furthermore, Israeli soldiers invaded Yatta and Dura towns and kidnapped five Palestinians after searching their homes. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, June 10th News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hussam Kassis and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is Iwanta Pula, Mike Kleffer, and Serena Fong. The producer is Serena Fong. And special thanks to KBOO reporter Jimmy Tardy and the reporters at laborradio.org. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. And finally, the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg.
A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with.
The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Serena Fong.
And I'm John Rasmussen. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, Joe Uris hosts a discussion of the cost of living, Social Security, and the shafting of the old and poor.
At 9 on Alternative Radio, noted scholar and author Noam Chomsky speaks on Magna Carta, then and now. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein.
At 11 on Stage and Studio, host D. Mae Roberts previews two summer festivals. Her guests are Jerry Teaster, director of the Risk/Reward Festival, which pushes artistic boundaries in dance, theater, and music, as well as curator and performer Eleanor O'Brien of the Coho Productions Solo Summer 2013, featuring five female solo artists. At 11:30 on Art Focused, host Joseph Gallivan interviews Viennese bike collector and architect Michael Embacher, whose collection forms the basis of the Portland Art Museum's new show, Cyclopedia, Iconic Bicycle Design. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can go become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the Worker Run Collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, John.
Good night, Serena.